Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, you want to live forever? Or a little longer? Maybe. It's a possibility. This is fascinating. Some fascinating research out here. By the way, welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. Had a great time in San Francisco over the weekend. Friday night, the great debate down at the Quake in San Francisco. Well, 1 week from today, this program, which is right now carried in the evenings on the Quake in San Francisco, will be going live. Now, that'll be a hoot. And also going live on the Quake. And, I'm Jerry Doyle and Rusty Humphries were the two national conservatives who were on this panel. Stephanie Miller and Johnny Steele, who's local in San Francisco, and Stephanie out of Los Angeles, and Rachel Maddow out of, she lives in Massachusetts, I believe, but, you know, out of New York, more or less, here in America, and I were debating. And afterwards, spent a little time with Jerry Doyle. It's amazing. You get to know people, and even when you detest their politics, you discover that they're decent people. So sometimes that's depressing, you know, but there you go. What can you say? Anyhow, it was a great event, and 1,500 people showed up, and we had a lot of people on our side. I'd say we won the debate, but, of course, you know, that's what everybody says. And then on Saturday, up Seattle way, went to a fundraiser at Pierce County and Pierce County Democrats, and a fine bunch of folks. And Senator Maria Cantwell was there. It was a nice opportunity to meet her. I'd never met her before. Very gracious, gracious person. She gave a great speech about, you know, just a barn burner of a short, tight speech on you know, what she wants to do and the direction she'd like to see this country go. And then Harry Reid got up and gave a nice talk. And then when he was all done, he said some very nice words about me, which was totally unexpected. So anyhow, I had a great time, and then Sunday got home. So, anti-aging, Newt Gingrich. I've got a bunch of relatively unconnected, but in a way, kind of, they are connected, things that I wanted to share with you here in the first hour of the program. Our telephone number, by the way, local number, 866-440-8466, 1-866-440-8466. Just to give you a heads up about the rest of the program, in the second hour of our program, we're going to have Arianna Huffington on. And in the third hour of our program, we're going to have three guests. We're going to have Larissa Alexandrovna of Raw Story, editor of Raw Story, about the Iran-Contra and Pete Hoekstra of Michigan. It should be an interesting piece. And Wendy Wild is going to be with us here as our Taking Back America candidate. She's from Minnesota's. She's running for Congress as a Democrat in Minnesota's 3rd District. And Ian Inaba, endtheblackout.org, the website. End the Blackout is the movie. I screened part of that movie on a panel with Ian at Bioneers 2 weekends ago in San Rafael. And it's just a marvelous piece of filmmaking about election theft. So anyhow, before I get to the anti-aging thing, this Newt Gingrich, one of the folks in the chat room actually shared this with me, and you can get to our chat room by going to tomhartman.com and just click the live chat link up at the top. There's no fee or anything in there, and it's a great place. You hang out with some of the finest minds in the entire internet. And one of the folks there, and by the way, if you've got stories and things you want to let me know about, don't email them to me. That type of email, the, hey, you've got to look at this stuff. I get so much of it. I get 500-600 of them a day that I can't read them. I delete them all unread. But people drop in the chat room and they, you know, pop up a link and say, hey, look at this. And I do. And this was a good one. He's back. Newt Gingrich returns with a new book on God in America. This from the Wall of Separation, the official blog of AU.org, Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. Just when you thought it was safe to go into the bookstore again, along comes word that Newt Gingrich has written a new volume on the place of God in the nation's capital. It's called, the title of Newt's new book, Rediscovering God in America, Reflections on the Role of Faith in Our Nation's History and Future. And in this book, what he does is basically he travels around Washington, D.C. and says, oh, look at this landmark. This is what that means. And look at this. This is what that means. And that sort of thing. For example, he says the 1963 Supreme Court, he's talking about the Supreme Court. He says the 1963 Supreme Court ruling that said that it was against the law to force children to listen to a Bible reading in school every morning was a 5-4 decision, implying that there was a lot of debate about it on the court and that maybe if we just get, you know, one more good conservative judge on, we could undo it. No, in fact, it was an 8-1 decision. There was only one dissenter. He also said that, Newt Gingrich, I mean, this is, sometimes it's, it would be funny if it weren't so tragic because he's taken so seriously and he's on, I mean, he's just doing the media blitz on this thing right now. He says that in the Supreme Court, the Ten Commandments and Moses are prominently displayed in the United States Supreme Court. Now, that would make you think that there's like, you know, a statue in the Supreme Court of Moses holding the Ten Commandments, and you can actually read them, you know, honor your father and mother and have no gods before me, and you shall not deny people a right to have weapons. Oh, no, that's the other one. Yeah, but see, that's the problem. There are only two of the Ten Commandments that actually are part of law. You know, don't steal and don't kill. I guess you could argue that it's against the law in certain contexts in some ways to covet your neighbor's wife, but I don't think coveting is actually specifically banned. It's not against the law to diss your parents. It's not against the law not to have a single god. It's not against the law to make graven images. Basically, out of the Ten Commandments, only two of them are part of law, and as Thomas Jefferson pointed out, they were part of law before Christianity came to England. He talks about, you know, Jefferson talking about the arrival of Christianity in England. He says, this is a February 10th, 1814 letter to Dr. Thomas Cooper. He said, finally, in answer to Fortescue Allen's question why the Ten Commandments should not be now a part of the common law of England, we may say they are not because they never were. Anyone who asserts that the Ten Commandments are the basis of British law was mistakenly believing a document that was a manifest forgery. The reason is simple. British common law, on which American common law was based, existed before Christianity had arrived in England. As Jefferson writes, Sir Matthew Hale lays it down in these words, Christianity is parcel of the laws of England. But, he says, it couldn't be. He says, quote, but Christianity was not introduced until the 7th century, the conversion of the first Christian king of the Heptarchy having taken place about the year 598, and that of the last at 686. Hence, here then was a space of 200 years during which the common law of England was in existence and Christianity was no part of it. We might as well say that the Newtonian system of philosophy is a part of the common law as that the Christian religion is. In truth, the alliance between church and state in England has ever made their judges accomplices in the frauds of the clergy and even bolder than they are. So Jefferson was pretty, you know, pretty outspoken that the British common law and American law, for that matter, is not based on the Ten Commandments. In fact, he says it was not the sacred volumes that the churches have thus interpolated, gutted, and falsified, but the works of others relating to them and even the laws of the land. Our judges, too, have lent a ready hand to further these frauds and have been willing to lay the yoke of their own opinions on the necks of others to extend the coercions of municipal law to the dogmas of their religion by declaring that these make a part of the law of the land. In other words, this is back in 1814, January 24th, 1814, letter to John Adams. He's talking about how these guys are running around saying that Christianity is the basis of the American Constitution, when in fact it isn't. He was there, you know, his protege, James Madison, wrote the thing in large part. But most interesting, in Newt Gingrich's new book, he's out running around talking about this stuff. And he talks about the Jefferson Memorial, this monument, the Jefferson Memorial. And you can go stand in the Jefferson Memorial and look up, and etched in a circle around the top of the Jefferson Memorial is a quote from Jefferson. And it actually, in fact, is a quote from a letter in 1800 to Benjamin Rush, who was a dear friend of Jefferson's. In fact, in the letter, he asked Rush not to share it with anybody because it was just 2 months before the election, and he thought the letter was pretty inflammatory, and he didn't want it to get out, as they say. And so anyhow, here's the language, and this is what Gingrich points out. He says, Jefferson said that, where did it go here? Jefferson said, holy cow. Yeah, here we are. The etch on the, I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. Okay, so this is what's at the top of the Jefferson Memorial. It's etched all around the top of the, and it sort of sounds like Jefferson is like, you know, thumping on the Bible and he's talking about God and, you know, God is the basis of our, well, the real story of that quote is going to bug your eyeballs out. I'll tell you about it right after this break. 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program.
Myself, so I'm gonna let her do all the talking. Ooh. Ooh. I came across a place in the middle of nowhere with a big black horse and a cherry tree. Ooh. Ooh. I felt a little fear upon my back. I said, don't look back, just keep on walking. Ooh. Ooh. When the big black horse said, look this way, he said, hey,
and welcome back to the place where smart people get the news. Tom Hartman radio program. Okay, so here it is. Here's the meme. Newt Gingrich is running around the country. He's doing all the talk shows. He's going to be on TV. You'll see him all over the place. He's got this new book out, Rediscovering God in America. And one of his favorite sound bites is quoting Thomas Jefferson, where Jefferson says, I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. And Jefferson, in fact, did say that. He said it in a letter that he wrote to Ben Rush, a dear friend of his, a physician, who was a deist and a Unitarian, as was Jefferson. And here's the letter that Jefferson wrote. Now, this is 2 months before the election. He writes, Dear Sir, I promised you a letter on Christianity, which I have not forgotten. I do not know that it would reconcile the genus irritable vetum, which is Latin for angry priests, basically, who are all, vetum, the same root word as Vatican, who are all in arms against me. Their hostility is on too interesting a ground to be softened. And then he talks about the First Amendment, which, you know, guarantees freedom of religion. He said the delusion on the clause of the Constitution, which, while it secured the freedom of the press, also covered the freedom of religion, has given the clergy a very favorite hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity throughout the United States. And as every sect believes its own form to be the one true one, everyone perhaps hoped for his own, but especially the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists. Then he refers to the probability that he will be elected president, which he refers to as the returning good sense of our country. He says, to continue, there is no interruption in this. This is a continuous letter that I'm reading to you. It's, you know, no ellipses. He says, the returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes. And they, the preachers, believe that any portion of power confided to me, such as his being elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes. And they believe rightly, for I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me, but it is enough, too, in their opinion. You get that? Gingrich is running around saying that Here's the quote from Jefferson. I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. Doesn't that show that he was a Bible-thumping Christian and that he thought that religion should be part of America? And in fact, the truth, the full quote was, the preachers believe that any portion of power confided in me, such as being elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes, and they believe rightly. For I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me, and enough, too, in their opinion. So there you have it. Anyway, I just had to get that covered. This is it. Higgins, my cat, woke me up. He must have woke me up three or four times last night. Higgins is having some problems. Louise had to rush him to the vet on Saturday. And this is our attack cat. Our son rescued him from a dorm where the kids, these boys in this dorm room used to throw him against the wall when he got out of line. He was living with a pit bull. He thought he was a pit bull. He was starving. His favorite food is potato chips and pizza. He will tear up. You leave a bag of potato chips around, he'll tear it open because that's what he was fed. His only source of water was the shower. So if you turn on the shower, he's there. He wants to with his tongue out. I mean, even now, here, 5-6 years later. But he's an attack cat, and Louise took him into the vet, and the vet says, oh, what a nice cat. And Louise is like, don't try touching him without gloves on. And, oh, no, no. And Higgins is purring, and the vet goes over to Higgins, and Higgins starts purring and meowing. And Louise says, that's his meow that I'm going to attack you. And the vet is like, oh, no, cats don't attack me. And she puts her hand on the gun, Higgins, and bang! He's all, you know, shred that hand! So they had to give him gas. Knock him out. It's amazing. So anyhow, Higgins as well. For the Higgins fans among us, there is some sort of a problem going on. Maybe that male cat dry food thing. I don't know. We'll find out. But I have a letter about somebody talking about health insurance here that I wanted to share with you. And then get into this researchers seek the key to anti-aging. This is fascinating. What fasting and red wine can do for you. A lot of economic news, and we'll be taking your calls right after the break. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. And when you're out there without care, yeah, I was out of touch. But it wasn't because I didn't know enough. I just knew too much. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and slightly unbalanced. The Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-8466. Let's just to wrap up this topic of Jefferson and early Christianity in America, you know, the fact of the matter is there were some God-fearing Christians among the founders. By and large, they were concentrated in the state of Massachusetts, which nearly seceded from the Union during Jefferson's presidency over the issue of religion. Ben Franklin left his home state of Massachusetts when he was 17 years old because they were still prosecuting women as witches, and he was horrified by it. He went to Philadelphia, where you could practice any or no religion, and was pretty unabashed about that in his autobiography. It's worth reading. James in New Paltz, New York. Hey, James, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, Tom. The only thing I can say about your last introduction was amen. A couple of points I'd like to add to that. I was just looking at this website. If you look at the Capitol building now and the various other structures around, you'll find more Masonic symbols than anything else. And you will. And I don't want to get into this whole Masonic conspiracy because every time I bring this up, that's where people go. It's just to say that I know that George Washington was a Mason. And
When he was inaugurated, the procession. I've seen the woodblock cutting in the National Archives. The procession was a Masonic parade. I mean, all these different Masonic halls holding their banners with their their numbers and all that kind of thing. Jefferson, by the way, never joined the Masons.
No.
So there were some founders who were and some who weren't.
Yeah. And one thing about Jefferson, I believe in the Smithsonian, you will actually see a copy of the Bible that he put together. And I posted a blog on your website.
You can buy it right now.
What?
You can buy it. It's been continuously in print since about 1820 or so when he put it into print. It's called the Jefferson Bible. It's the first four Gospels, the first four books of the New Testament. And what he did was he stripped out all of the miracles.
Yeah, the miracles and the revelations, because he didn't believe in them. And I think maybe there's something to be said about that. I get scared when I see us as a people, like we're looking up at the sky for some sign from Providence, and I don't know.
Yeah, he saw Jesus as one of the greatest philosophers who ever lived, but he didn't view him as a deity. I at a certain level, I disagree with Jefferson. But that's my own take on Christianity. I consider myself a Christian, so I guess I'm more. I'm more bought into it than he was, but I certainly understand his perspective. I very much do. So.
Well, my issue is not so much that. It's what Gingrich is saying and how it is. I wish someone would debate him with this information and see how he responds to it.
Well, he won't put himself in a position where that could happen.
Yeah. And just tell him, even though, one more thing, just look in the back of a U.S. dollar bill.
Oh, yeah, those are all Masonic symbols, certainly. Yeah. Thanks, James, for the call. Here's another interesting story about this. The founders thought that there should be a goddess for America. There was, there were the gods or the god. Most of them were either Christian or came out of that tradition. And so, of course, there was, God the Father and Jesus and all that kind of thing. And they were all male. And they were recreating a democratic republic in borrowing heavily from the Greek democracy and from the Roman Republic, and both the Greeks and the Romans had goddesses as well as gods for their nations. And so some of the founders and the framers thought, we should have a goddess for America as well as the gods who are embodied in our religion, that our religions are primarily male and patriarchal and patrilineal, so we should have a goddess as well. And so they got together and they created one. They created a goddess for America. And I remember debating Bill Bennett and a couple of other conservatives at the Heritage Foundation on C-SPAN. This was, must have been about 2-3 years ago. And one of the interns there at the Heritage Foundation was showing me around the place, and which is just, it's a very, very impressive place. A lot of money there. And she took me up on the roof where they were building out a TV studio, and we're standing on the roof, and she's showing me the Capitol building, which is just a few blocks away, and there's, on top of the Capitol, there's this statue. And 19.5-foot tall statue. And I said, "Do you know who that statue is?" And she said, "No." And I said, "And you graduated with a degree in what?" And she's like, "Political science, but I don't know who the statue is." And I'm like, "Oh, man." Well, The founders came up with this idea of a goddess for America, and they felt that, first of all, they named her after Christopher Columbus, because the widespread mythology at the time was that Columbus discovered North America. We know now that it was the Norwegians, actually, but Columbus was the one who most visibly discovered North America, and so they created a feminized version of his name and gave that to the goddess. And she appears, she's appeared on our coins continuously from the founding of this country up until about 30 years ago, up until the Reagan administration, in various forms, the Liberty Walking Quarter, the Liberty Silver Dollars, the goddess. The French were so taken with her that they gave us a statue of her that is in New York Harbor, the Statue of Liberty. There are songs written to her, Hail Columbia. She appears in many different forms because the Greeks had all different goddesses with different names. And there was the goddess of war and Helena, I believe it was, and the goddess of liberty and the goddess of scales of justice. Well, in the Justice Department, for example, John Ashcroft covered her exposed breast with a cloth. That was the goddess. That was Columbia. Standing there holding a scale. She was there at the Department of Justice. She's the goddess of law, of justice. She appears in some places as the goddess of war, or the goddess of peace, arguably, carrying a shield in one hand and a bundle of arrows in another. On the tops of some state capitals, she's the goddess of agriculture, holding a handful of wheat or corn. So she took many different forms. And they when they designed Washington, D.C., they felt that there should be a separate district that was sacred and that was consecrated to the goddess. And so, and that it would be such a sacred thing to live in this place, in this district of the goddess Columbia, that if you lived there because you had committed yourself to the sacred work of governing the nation, that you would voluntarily surrender your right to have representation in Congress. And so people who live in the District of Columbia, the District of the Goddess, do not have a representative in Congress. They don't have a senator, and their member of Congress is only an observer. They basically don't have a vote. And so, you know, you've seen the goddess, America's goddess, all over the place. I mean, she's on top of the Capitol building. She's been on our coins. She is again, I believe, all over. And I remember when I was living in Vermont back, must have been five years ago or so, right after Bush became president, but before I had started doing this radio program. We've been doing the program for 3.5 years, so it must have been about four and a half years ago. I remember we didn't have a television, and we were not on a 24-hour news cycle like I am now, because I didn't have to stay informed for the radio show. So I read the newspaper every morning. I went out and got the newspaper and sat down with Louise, and we were going to have a cup of coffee and read the paper. And I opened up the paper, and here in giant type is the headline, Columbia Dies Over Texas. And I remember so vividly, my first thought was, my God, George Bush got her. He killed her. I thought, you know, I thought that this was a relatively, you know, obscure story about the whole story of how Columbia came to be, from the District of Columbia to the Statue of Liberty and everything else, you know, that America actually has a goddess, because it's not something that's normally taught in our schools, because a lot of Christians, frankly, think that it's blasphemous for the nation to have a goddess. And because the first commandment is, thou shalt have no other gods before me, right? So anyhow, here's the headline, Columbia Dies Over Texas, and turns out it was the space shuttle. And but there was just that moment where I was like, wow. So anyway, I found that fascinating. Another thing that I find fascinating is how I have been hearing on progressive talk radio these calls on a regular basis, almost every day it seems, and you wonder if they're running a boiler room out of Kansas or something, where they call in and they go, you know, you're complaining, but you don't offer any solutions. And I would say that, by and large, those are people who don't listen to the program. For example, Russell in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Russell.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind, Russell?
Well, one thing, I just finished reading your book.
Which one?
Screwed.
Uh-huh.
And by the way, I think the ad that runs on your show that says Get Screwed by Tom Hartman is a little out of date.
Get Screwed by Tom Hartman.
Yeah.
But the book was quite good. It motivated me to follow up and read up on Thomas Jefferson and FDR.
Mm-hmm.
I was amazed that some of the things that they were saying are so relevant to what's going on today.
They are. They really and truly are.
But anyway, I feel like you have a giant electronic megaphone that you could be using to try to help people. By the way, I'm not from Kansas. that you could be using to help people take action to try to counter some of the problems that are going on.
You mean like my regular solution that we return to tariffs and walk away from our trade policies, my regular suggestion that we lift the cap on Social Security and solve that problem, my regular solution that if we simply did away with the inability of the government to negotiate drug prices, we'd save $900 billion in the Medicare program over a 10-year period and solve the problem of Medicare?
Yeah, a lot of that stuff is in your book too, Tom, but you talk about it, but you're not showing how anybody can do anything about it.
Well, the way to do it is to get...
Real
simply, Russell, is right now, unfortunately, is to get Democrats elected to the House of Representatives and the Senate, because the Republicans are doing everything they can to shoot down any efforts on these parts. They won't even raise the minimum wage. 45 minutes past the hour.
Purging voters from the rolls, 30 points down in the polls. Bye, bye. Blackwell. now just between you and your God. Bye, bye, Blackwell. Your protection order won't protect you. Then your own party won't elect you. Neocons all jump for joy. He's your wingnut poster boy. Blackwell, bye-bye.
And welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. The Tom Hartmann Program, 51 minutes past the hour. Here's a few other suggestions right out of the box. Of course, Nancy Pelosi has her first 100 hours. You know, let's clean up some of the corruption in Washington, D.C. Let's investigate some of these phony no-bid contracts, all this other stuff. But just fundamental stuff. Let's go back to enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, which Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing in 1982, which led to the mergers and acquisitions mania. And let's break up some of these giant behemoths. Let's reexamine the possibility, you know, the whole doctrine of corporate personhood, so that local communities can once again say to big out-of-state corporations, no, we'd rather not have you conduct yourself that way. But here, you know, Nancy Pelosi, she says, if the Democrats are elected, day one, put new rules in place to break the link between lobbyists and legislation. Day two, enact all the recommendations made by the commission on 9/11. Time remaining, and until 100 hours, she would raise the minimum wage to $7.25 an hour, cut the interest rate on student loans in half, allow the government to negotiate directly with pharmaceutical companies for lower drug prices for Medicare patients, and broaden the types of stem cell research allowed with federal funds. This is in her first 100 hours. Seems pretty straightforward to me. How do you do that? How do you get that? Vote Democratic. Very simple. And I say that as somebody who's registered as an independent voter. Vote Democratic. Jude in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jude, what's on your mind today?
Hi, good morning, Tom. Thanks for Saturday. It was just a great thing at King's Bookstore.
Oh, well, thank you for showing up, Jude. It was nice meeting you.
Last week, Tom, I ended up calling the Elections Board, and I kind of got into a different section, and the gal spent time with me on the phone. And my concern was about an article Seattle Times had. They had 1,100 voters that were registered voters, and they ended up sending them through a private carrier. So they were a day late, and they were negated. Hmm. And then I also wanted to find out about the Diebold machines, which she had no idea.
Yeah.
But we started talking, and I could tell she felt pressured. And I said, you know, if you ever want to call me, I said, I'd love to speak with you. Well, she called me last night, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that they had brought up in the office that there were 6,000 ballots down at the annex that had not even been recorded.
Hmm.
And, again, I don't know the individual. But we went on, you know, with them. She just talked and talked and talked. She said that this year that they were actually discouraging sending out the pamphlets for the November election because of the money, and they were referring them on to, you know, to the online. But there's so many individuals that that's not viable for them.
Sure.
And so that was a major concern. And then she also brought up about, I asked her about the provisional voting, because
mm-hmm.
I work in the polls. And what they do is they have two people. They open those provisional ballots, and then they have another an individual reads from the actual district ballot, mm-hmm. and a person writes over from the original voter onto the new ballot and puts in the markings. So it's
and so the provisional ballot itself isn't counted. It is
it's transcribed onto another district ballot.
Oh, that's interesting.
And she said her concern is they all work hard, but they don't necessarily always check one another.
Sure.
And after elections, you know, they're into 10, 11, 12 hours.
Yeah.
It was very, so I ended up calling McDermott's office this morning, Tom, and spoke with one of the aides because it really bothers me.
Yeah.
And again, you know, sometimes things cannot be true, but there's just too much going on.
Yeah. You know, in Washington State, I really doubt that there's any Ken Blackwell kind of stuff going on.
Right. But, we have not had a lot of difficulty. We have not.
Right. But what you do have is, you know, the Help America Vote Act has put all these mandates and all these restrictions. And basically, you know, it was designed to transfer enormous amounts of state money and and several billion dollars of federal money to the Republican crony corporations associated with the voting machines.
Yes.
And to the private corporations like ChoicePoint that are coming in and saying, OK, we'll take care of your voter rolls. It's all about privatizing the vote. And at the same time, there hasn't been much emphasis at all. I've never heard an ad, for example, or a PSA saying that people should do like my parents' generation did in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, you know, volunteer to be a poll worker. You know, you do your civic duty, show up, participate.
Absolutely. At the September primary, there were three women, and we had nine districts between us.
Yeah. Yeah, so good on you, Jude, for showing up. I appreciate that. And thanks for showing up yesterday at the book signing, too. It was a pleasure to meet you and to sign your book. But
did you get to see the crow's nest from that I gave you?
Yes. Oh, wait a minute. This is the the
Great Harbor.
Yeah, it was fascinating.
Awesome.
Yes. Thank you very much, Jude. I appreciate it. And thanks for the call, and thanks for dropping by. We'll be back with right after the break. Arianna Huffington, and then we'll be taking more of your calls, and I still want to get to this, how can you live forever thing? Well, not live forever. How can you extend your lifespan by about 40%? Might be easier than you think. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. The basis of the Iraq War, we're now learning, was fear. Fear itself. The basis of the Iraq War. This is from Agence France-Presse, an al-Qaeda terror suspect captured by the United States who gave evidence of links between Iraq and the terror network, confessed after being tortured, a journalist told the BBC. Now, keep in mind, this is Ibn al-Shaikh al-Libi. This is the guy whose testimony. This is the guy whose testimony formed the basis of the Bush administration's policy that we should invade, that there was a legitimate reason for us to invade Iraq. Libby was tortured in an Egyptian prison, according to Stephen Gray, author of the newly released book Ghost Plane, who investigated the secret U.S. intelligence CIA prisons that housed terror suspects around the world. Libby was apparently taken to Cairo after being captured in Afghanistan in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. Libby claims he was tortured in jail, and that would be routine in Egyptian prisons, Gray says. What he claimed most significantly was a connection between al-Qaeda and the Iraqi regime of Saddam Hussein. This intelligence report made it all the way to the top and was used by former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell as a key piece of justification for invading Iraq. Fear itself. Fear itself. I mean, that's the basis of the whole thing, right?
Be afraid, September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning.
This from Bush's speech before the Republican National Convention in 2004. In order.
Evil terrorists, danger, doomed killers. Be afraid. The world will drift toward tragedy. May God bless you. Evil God. Iraq, darkness. The continuing danger of terrorism. Be afraid. We have fought the terrorists across the earth. Evil. We are staying on the offensive, striking terrorists abroad, and nothing will hold us back. And we will prevail. Be afraid. God bless America. Nuclear weapons. Iraq was a gathering threat.
And it continues, and I contrast that with Franklin Roosevelt.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
Indeed. And now we discover that even the main purveyor of fear itself, Mr. Bush, acquired the information that he used to drive us into this phony war, based on terror, on inflicting terror on an individual using torture. Tragic. Gail in Olympia, Washington. Oh, hang on just a second here, Gail. We have Arianna Huffington is with us. Arianna Huffington, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. I just played, it was really a setup for your coming on the program here. I played a clip from Bush before his RNC speech that was just a whole series of...
Be afraid, September the 11th.
...of these kinds of things, followed by Franklin Roosevelt.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
And you have a new book out on being fearless in love, work, and life. And I realize that to a certain extent it's sort of a self-help book for women, but it's also a frame for a larger national issue, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, you gave me goosebumps as I was listening to FDR, because although the book is about building a personal foundation of fearlessness in all areas of our lives, from that personal foundation, we can actually become effective leaders and effective citizens. Because what, Tom, I believe has happened is that so many of our leaders have actually bought into the Republican fear-mongering, not just about smoking guns turning into mushroom clouds, which is how we got into Iraq, but also about the fear of being perceived as soft on national security, fear of being framed as cutting and running. And all these are nothing but fears. It's kind of ironic that Democrats were constantly afraid of talking about leaving Iraq because that was supposed to be against the tough staying on course message of the president, are now hearing the president trying to run away from staying the course.
Yeah.
So
well,
that shows, you know, how afraid we have been, and I hope that the book between now and the election will help spread that kind of epidemic of fearlessness, because fear is the only thing that would get Republicans reelected.
Yes, and fearlessness is what we need. And there's a certain element of schoolyard bully about the Republicans. And one of the things that I recall from growing up is that the schoolyard bully was often one of the most brittle and fragile people in the schoolyard. And when confronted and when backed down, it often collapsed very, very quickly. And I'm wondering when the Democrats are going to get it, that Bush is playing a bully routine, and if they were to aggressively call him on it, he'd roll over.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. And, you know, that is really what has been stunning to me, Tom, all those years, 6 years, of allowing Bush to frame the issue, especially on national security. And, you know, it's interesting you played FDR, because I went back and looked at what made FDR make that statement, and it was really his own personal foundation of fearlessness after dealing with polio, after, as he said, having spent 2 years trying to wiggle his big toe and beginning to believe that he could handle anything after that. And that's really what is missing from so many of our leaders.
Well, I understand Rush Limbaugh now says that FDR faked his polio to get sympathy. just kidding. We're talking with Arianna Huffington. Her new book, On Becoming Fearless in Love, Work, and Life, also HuffingtonPost.com, of course, her blog, and a great website. Arianna, what's the most effective way that we can spread fearlessness as a meme in the political arena, other than simply speaking of it?
You mean other than reading my book, Tom?
Yes, indeed.
Well, in fact, you know what? Together with the Progressive States Network and the White House Project, we've gotten about 1,000 books out that were donated by my publisher to men and women running for office in this election, from Congress and the Senate down to the Board of Supervisors, because we really believe that if candidates tap into their own fearlessness, they will sound different. They will not sound so cowed by the kind of fear-mongering that especially just before an election becomes worse and and more scary mm-hmm. than before.
Well, and having fear is part of the normal human condition. I mean, it's
absolutely
a fundamental,
you know,
survival instinct.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because fearlessness is not the absence of fear. The way I define it in the book is the mastery of fear. It's doing what you believe is right and saying what you know is right, even while you're afraid, even while you're being attacked and criticized.
And you've certainly experienced that in your own life.
Absolutely, and I write about that. You know, often people say to me, oh, when were you afraid? And so I write chapter and verse all the dozens of times in my life when I confronted major fears, whether it was being a gawky, too tall girl growing up in Athens when I was 5'10 and my classmates were 5'0, or speaking at the Cambridge Union with this accent, which, as you probably have seen, I've now lost.
Yeah, brilliantly, too.
And being ridiculed but persevering, to having a book rejected by 37 publishers, to having a man I was in love with not wanting to marry me. You know, I write all that because I believe it's important for others to see how all of us face failure and setbacks in our lives. And the difference is how quickly do we recover and how quickly do we bounce back. That's what fearlessness is.
Persistence.
Persistence, exactly. Not getting discouraged is the key to
yes.
success. And embracing failure is ironically the key to success, because there's nobody who has succeeded who has not failed along the way. And as a mother, you know, I have two teenage daughters to whom the book is dedicated. I try to drum this into their heads more than anything, because so often many of us don't try new things because we're afraid we will fail. I know it happened to me with the Huffington Post. You know, before we launched it, there were so many doubters and naysayers. You had to sort of plow on and take the risk.
Sure. And we must figure out some way to infect the Democratic Party with this meme of fearlessness, this idea of fearlessness. Send out copies of your book to every member of the party.
But you're right. It is a meme of fearlessness. And in the same way that fear is contagious, fearlessness is contagious, too.
Yeah.
And it only takes a critical mass to change the perception and to change the climate in which politicians are operating.
Well said. Arianna Huffington, her new book, I'm Becoming Fearless in Love, Work, and Life, HuffingtonPost.com, of course, her website. Arianna Huffington, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Good speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be right back.
We all know you rigged the fix. We're up on all your dirty tricks. Bye, bye, Blackwell.
Oh, one can only hope.
Elections without oversight make miracles happen overnight. Bye, bye, Blackwell.
Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Joy in Santa Cruz, California, KRXA. Hey, Joy, what's up?
Hi, I just thought you would want to know about this one. Miami Herald is reporting that Broward County voting machines are switching to the Republicans when people vote Democrat in early voting.
There's already?
Already. Broward poll workers can't even report these machines messing up until the early voting period ends.
You're kidding. Why?
I don't know. That's what it says here. Basically, there's like Democrats who've been going in there who've been voting a straight party ticket, and they have to keep re-voting on the same machine until the Democrats come up. It switches over to the Republicans. Just like, you know, it's the flip-flopping.
Sure.
But it's happening now.
Yeah, and this has been for 6 years this has been reported in race after race after race, happening right now in Broward County. Amazing.
Right now.
Joy, thanks for the heads up. David's on it. We'll be looking for the story, get the details on it.
It's on Daily Kos, first thing on the right.
Okay, great. Thanks
okay.
a lot. Appreciate
Bye.
It. Dan in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hello.
Hey, Dan.
Oh, yeah, hi. Tom, I'm sorry.
It's quite all right. You are live and on the air.
I hope the cell phone works okay. My question is, alternative to NAFTA, alternative to leveling this playing field as they're trying to do with the world economy, so forth. I'm not sure. I don't like NAFTA. It's hurting me, but what's the alternative? I mean, how do you, if you've got a world view and you expect to somehow let the third world countries compete with us and other better countries, what is the alternative? I mean, how do we?
Why should we let third world countries compete with us?
I'm sorry?
Why should we let third world countries compete with us?
Well, I mean, if you said you're a Christian, right?
Yep.
And you're supposed to consider all the people of the world.
Yep.
So how do we consider them if we're going to put them back in the?
What you find, Dan, is that when jobs get offshored to third world countries, by and large, those countries become actually poverty increases in those countries, not decreases. Mexico is a great example of that. NAFTA has increased poverty in Mexico. It's also increased the wealth of a small number of billionaires and multimillionaires. It's increased the number of millionaires, and it's increased poverty. It has not increased the middle class. Every country has an obligation, a necessity to create their own economy that works for them based on their natural resources, based on their culture, based on their population, ranging from their population density to the assets of their population, their ability to educate their people and you know, just a whole series of things. And to simply say that we should, erase all boundaries and allow a free and open competition of labor in a world where there's 6.5 billion people is only going to benefit multinational corporations and billionaires, period. Everybody else is going to get screwed. By going back to a tariff system like most countries actually have right now, most countries in the world use tariffs to protect their economies. And, in fact, China uses tariffs to protect their economy. If you want to manufacture a car in the United States and import it into China, the tariff is 22%. And yet, if China wants to import a car into the United States, the tariff is 2%. Tell me what's wrong with that picture. Countries use tariffs in order to, number one, define sectors of their economy that they consider critical, that they don't ever want to go away regardless of competition. For example, defense manufacturing or clothing manufacturing or food production, things that are absolutely essential that in time of war or in time of natural disaster might cause a disaster if they're not available. And secondly, they use tariffs to level the playing field so that domestic industries actually stay as domestic industries. And tariffs are what built this nation, and as I said, they're in use by most countries in the world. And we have been the leader in the world of tearing down tariffs, and we have been the fastest in the world at losing our middle class as a consequence of it. It's just that simple. It worked for 200 years. Nobody else has come up with anything better. I mean, if you've got a better idea, let me know. I'd love to hear it.
No, I don't. I've been listening to you for some time, and you've really opened my eyes about some things. I just wish you were on for 3 hours. I have to listen to the cell phone right now. So.
No, I'm sorry to hear that. You're in Portland, Oregon, though.
I'm halfway between there and Seattle, actually.
Oh, I see. You're driving, and so you're listening on Sirius. Yeah, that's something you have to take up with the folks at Sirius. So because they run the rest of the show, but they delay it. They time delay it, as some of our stations do. But that's life. Dan, thank you for the call, though. I appreciate it. Good
pleasure.
Good to hear from you. We're gonna do our progressive pop quiz now. Our time for the Tom Hartman Daily Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question for the day: when Jefferson said, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man," what was the tyranny to which he was specifically referring? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-THOM, 866-440-8466, gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. The answer coming up right after the break. It's 27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
Serve somebody.
your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Jeffrey John Cox in Sacramento. Congratulations, Jeffrey John Cox. Where's that applause? He knows that the answer. When Thomas Jefferson said, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man," what was the tyranny he was referring to? And the answer, of course, is the tyranny of organized religion or the clergy. Specifically, that's what he was talking about in his letter to Benjamin Rush. And congratulations to Jeffrey John Cox, also known as Libertarian Jeff, for winning our progressive pop quiz for today. Just found the story here in the Miami Herald that our last caller told us about. One of the folks in the chat room tossed it to me. Charles Rabin and Dara Simon writing, "After a week of early voting, a handful of glitches with electronic voting machines have drawn the ire of voters. Reassurances from election supervisors and a caution against the careless casting of voters. Several South Florida voters say the choices they touched on the electronic screens were not the ones that appeared on the review screen, the final voting step. They say this is because the screens slip out of calibration." Huh? Yeah, you know, Diebold makes ATM machines, and I don't recall ever pushing the "I want $200 button and getting $500 out of a Diebold ATM machine. But somehow the Diebold voting machines, when you push the "I want to vote for the Democrat," they say, "Oh, thank you for voting for the Republican." Joan Merrick, 60, a Democrat from Hollywood, was also stunned to see Charlie Crist, the Republican, on her ballot review page after voting on Thursday. This is after several other people who have said this. "Am I on the voting screen again?" she says. She wondered, "Well, this is too weird." Yeah, Merrick corrected her ballot and alerted poll workers at the Hollywood Seattle courthouse, who said that they'd had previous problems with the same machine. Poll workers did some work on her machine when she finished voting, she said, but no report was made to the supervisor of elections, and the machine was not removed. Oh, my. So, Jebby is at it again, right? Which, in many ways, you know, just so reminds me of the situation in good old Italy, you know. It's, in fact, it's time for a Berlusconi alert. Yes, you know, Silvio Berlusconi, that guy who, small-time crook and businessman, bought a radio station, and then bought a television station, and bought a newspaper, and then bought another television station, and then another radio station, and pretty soon bought a radio network, and then another radio network, and then another television network, and then another television network, and then a couple more magazines, and a few more newspapers, and pretty soon he owned all the radio television stations, or networks, rather, in Italy. And then he decided to run for office. Gee, what a surprise. He won and became prime minister. Well, recently he lost. The people of Italy kind of got fed up with him. And now, this from Reuters, Dateline Milan, former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi and lawyer David Mills have been ordered to stand trial on corruption charges, a lawyer for Berlusconi said on Monday. Yes, Milan magistrates had accused Berlusconi of paying Mills, who is the estranged husband of Culture Secretary Tessa Jowell, a kickback for not revealing details of Berlusconi's media empire when he testified in two court cases. Silvio Berlusconi, down he goes. And a fine thing it is, by the way. Let me add, it's about time that Berlusconi got caught up with. Very quickly, let's check in with what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq. I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance. Security and other developments in Iraq as of 10:30 GMT on Monday. Dateline Kirkuk, a suicide attacker, blew himself up inside a police headquarters in the northern oil city of Kirkuk, killing two people and wounding 11, including five policemen. In Baghdad, a car bomb exploded in El Hafia district near Baghdad, killing two people and wounding five. In Sawaria, police retrieved the bodies of six policemen bearing signs of torture with bullet wounds from the river. A car bomb in Baghdad exploded in the Al Bayah district, killing seven people, wounding 25. In near Kalas, a roadside bomb struck a car carrying laborers, killing two and seriously wounding three. In Baghdad, a bomb blast ripped through a crowd of laborers in a square in Baghdad's Shiite Sadr city on Monday, killing 28 people and wounding 60. In Mumadia, police found six bodies bearing torture, signs of torture, blindfolded and with bullet wounds. In Baghdad, the U.S. military death toll in Iraq in October reached 100 after a U.S. Marine was killed Sunday in western Anbar province. And in Baghdad, gunmen shot dead Dr. Issam al-Rawi, head of the University Teachers Association in Iraq, near his home in Baghdad. Pretty grim. I promised you anti-aging. Let me share this with you fairly quickly. Back in the 30s, David Stipp has written about this in today's Wall Street Journal. Interesting article. Researchers seek key to anti-aging and calorie cutback. Back in the 1930s, they discovered that when they forced animals to periodically fast or to cut their calorie intake, made them skinny, or just periodically fasted them, that their lifespans extended by 30 to 40%. There's also considerable evidence that calorie restriction, or CR, would slow human aging, too, writes David Stipp in today's Wall Street Journal. So they're trying to figure out what it is that flips this on. What is it that causes the body to slow down its metabolism so we live longer? And obviously, you know, one of the things that does it is fasting, but not a lot of people are into fasting. I used to fast a lot when I was a kid. When I was younger, when I was in my 20s, Louise and I were into this serious health food thing, and we would fast periodically. And I think I need to start doing it again. Just take every Saturday and not eat. You know, literally fast for a day. That, you know, Friday fasting on Friday used to be the old Catholic thing long ago. Then it became, well, let's just not eat meat. And in Islam, there's a daily fast, you know, it's throughout Ramadan. Anyhow, much of the new focus, writes David Stipp in today's Wall Street Journal, is on a substance in, guess what, red wine, called resveratrol. So time to call the organic wine company at 1-888-ECO-WINE, right? Is that their phone number? Let me just make sure. Yeah, 1-888-ECO-WINE. Get some, because you don't want the chemicals, you just want the... Well, in the interest, it started 3 years ago when a group led by Harvard Medical School biologist David Sinclair reported that this resveratrol, this compound in red wine, boosted yeast cells' lifespan by 70% via a mechanism resembling calorie restriction. He later co-authored a study showing that it also boosts the lifespan of fruit flies and roundworms. Last spring, Italian scientists reported that resveratrol boosted lifespan more than 50% in a kind of short-lived fish. Intriguingly, the fish on resveratrol had much faster swimming speeds as they aged and spent far more time moving around than did undosed control fish. Thomas Jefferson, by the way, drank 2 glasses of wine with dinner every day of his life. He was quite the lover of red wine. Anyhow, the story of resveratrol has its roots in scientists' increased understanding of calorie restriction. In 1989, researchers, this again from David Stipp in today's Wall Street Journal. In 1989, researchers theorized that it activates a starvation response whose genetic machinery evolved eons ago to enable survival through periods of food shortage such as drought by retarding the rate of aging. The response blocks growth and reproduction in order to free up energy to slow aging. The energy is siphoned to cellular systems that limit damage from harmful free radical molecules and other toxins produced as metabolic byproducts in cells. The theory explained longstanding mysteries about calorie restriction, such as the fact that animals on calorie restriction become resistant to toxic chemicals. It also had a dismaying implication. Our obesity-fostering, high-calorie diets are putting us in fast-aging and fast-reproducing mode, which may be why childhood obesity is closely linked to early puberty, which now begins before 8 in many girls, and why adult obesity is linked to such a wide swath of aging diseases, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, arthritis, even Alzheimer's. So the moral of the story, I guess, either start fasting or start drinking red wine, or both. Gee, I'll go on a red wine fast every Saturday. There we go. Randy White's here. He's all in favor of that. That sounds like a plan. 1-866-440-8466. We have a little less than a minute here. Mike in Pennsylvania before we've got to take a break. What's on your mind, Mike?
Uh, people don't say three reasons why we went to Iraq. It's that you, but here's my opinion. Number one, two reasons, oil we all say number one, and number two reason, the bases, to have bases in Iraq. We spend over zillions of dollars. We got about 10 or more bases in Iraq,
yeah,
and we could
14.
Do what we want.
Yeah, they, well, the Project for New American Century. I mean, those guys are pretty upfront about it, Paul Wolfowitz. We need to have a footprint in the Middle East from which we can project force. And I believe you're right, Matt, Mike. The ideologues behind this thing, they were all about, yeah, absolutely, let's have military bases in the center of the Middle East. And they got it, that having our military bases in Saudi Arabia didn't work really well, because that's why Osama bin Laden attacked us, which, of course, is why George W. Bush pulled our guys out of Saudi Arabia, and, you know, so bin Laden would leave us alone. Good job, George. 45 minutes past the hour.
Let's be the good guys again. We're going down the wrong road, my friend. Let's return our nation to its true destination. Let's be the good guys again. Let's be one nation again. And work for the common good, my friends. Let's improve our highways, our parks, schools, and byways. Let's be one nation again.
What a novel idea.
Let's
welcome back, my friends.
Work
Tom Hartman here with you,
again.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Victoria Jones, our senior climate change correspondent with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C., on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Yes, indeed. Climate change correspondent. I was just listening to that bit just before about how poor polar bears' noses are too low.
Yeah.
I don't like that. Whoever planned the polar bear nose was not taking into account the kind of damage human beings could do with climate change, apparently.
Well, yeah, it is not good, actually. Polar bears are drowning, you know.
I know.
So, you know, not that you'd ever want to pet one, but
they look so cute.
Yeah, they do. They do look so cute.
They're fluffy.
They're great big carnivores.
Yeah.
In any case, what's going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, interestingly, I've been following the cable news networks this morning to see what kind of coverage this enormous report on climate change is receiving, because it's a huge story worldwide. And with the exception of a little bit of a report on CNN's International Hour, there's been virtually no coverage of it at all, because all the coverage, of course, is about the election. So basically, this report is going to sink.
Yeah, it's tragic. This is here's the report in summary. Just a couple of sentences. Unchecked global warming. This is from today's Wall Street Journal, but it's an AP story. Unchecked global warming will devastate the world economy on a scale of the world wars and the Great Depression, a major British government report said Monday, as the country launched a bid to convince doubters that environmentalism and economic growth go hand in hand. Introducing the report, Prime Minister Tony Blair said unabated climate change would eventually cost the world between 5% and 20% of gross domestic product each year. He called for bold and decisive action to cut carbon emissions and stem the worst of the temperature rise. And, in fact, I understand he's talking about hiring Al Gore to pitch the idea here in the United States.
That's absolutely right. They are looking to hire Al Gore to pitch the idea. Now, I'm not sure whether it's to pitch the idea in the United States or whether Al Gore...
Or in the United Kingdom.
I think Al Gore's going to be advising the UK government on the issue.
Right.
Which makes more sense, because I think hiring Al Gore for this country would be more of a divisive, you know, to work in this country would be more of a divisive mood or move, although I'm not sure that you and I agree entirely about that. But other than that, all the news really is about the elections. Nothing else is going on in the world at all except elections. The president is traveling today. He'll be traveling some tomorrow. He'll be traveling on at least one other day this week. And, of course, we're assured that he will be applying himself to the work of the country as well. That nothing will be missed in all this time that he'll be campaigning and fundraising.
Tragic.
So we have nothing to worry about.
There you go. Victoria, let's take a couple calls together here.
Okay.
Gail in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Gail.
Hi. How are you?
Good. You're live with Victoria and me.
I enjoyed meeting you so much Saturday at the Keep Pierce Blue Project. I was one of the hostesses.
Oh, great. Well, thank you, Gail.
Yeah.
Thank you for volunteering and showing up to help the Pierce County Democratic Party there.
Now what we need is we need for every one of your listeners all over to get out this next week and work on poll watching, canvassing, telephone banks. And if all the people would do that, we could have a really big victory on the 7th.
I absolutely agree. Gail, for our listeners in Pierce County, Washington, the Tacoma area, how do they do that? How do they contact
you? In our area, they go to our Democratic Combined Campaign Headquarters, which we started with Maria Cantwell, and then the representatives and the locals, is at 711 St. Helens in Tacoma.
Okay.
And on the corner of 7th and St. Helens. Great. You can just drop in, volunteer to work, and they can connect people with the Seattle office or any of the local offices that would be closer to their own home.
Great. Gail, thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Thank you for the call. Victoria Jones, Gail's call raises an interesting question. How do we get more young people involved in doing what Gail is doing, in participating and volunteering? It seems like the last generation to really do that in a big way was my mother's generation and perhaps Gail's generation.
You know, I don't know, and I think it's a little odd that they're not involved, because when you look at the kind of scheduling that kids have at school and the volunteering that they have to do in order to get decent scores to get into college, they are very involved in the community, because they have to be.
Yeah.
But it doesn't translate to the elections, and they don't seem to have a big interest in voting. I do think VH1 and MTV and things like that can be even more involved than they are. And I have not noticed any big push for voting, by the way, on VH1, which I watch every day.
You do?
I watch it every day.
What is VH1?
VH1 is one of the video channels.
Is it like rock video? Music
videos? Yeah, it's top 40 videos mostly.
Uh-huh. Okay. Forgive my ignorance. I'm a cultural illiterate here.
Yeah, no, I watch it in very early in the morning at the gym. It's how I keep up with what songs are in the charts.
Yeah, and how you keep yourself going on the machines.
Often there's this rock the vote thing on MTV, but I've seen no major push this time to get young people out to vote.
Yeah, and not just to vote, to get them to volunteer, to be poll workers, and elections officials and stuff. These are all voluntary positions here. It's important stuff. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, the website. Thanks for being with us, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you today. 56 minutes past the hour. In the next hour, Larissa Alexandrovna is going to be with us. Wendy Wild from Minnesota, running for Congress in the 3rd District. And Ian Inaba, who is working on he's with the Guerrilla News Network, has this great new documentary out. EndTheBlackout.org is the website. And we'll be talking about that. And taking your calls. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Iran-Contra? Thought that was over, didn't you? Pete Hoekstra from Michigan. Thought he was just a normal guy, all right? Larissa Alexandrovna of RawStory.com on the line with us. Larissa, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this investigative report that you've done.
Well, this particular visit is part of a series of visits. The head of the House Intelligence Committee, Peter Hoekstra, traveled abroad recently to meet with Iranian arms dealer and Iran-Contra figure Manacher Gurbanifar. He took along with him a man by the name of Von Forrest, who is a shady figure, also very closely tied to Iran-Contra. And after my actual my report ran, another report in the American Conservative ran, discussing the same allegations, adding that as part of the meeting, a terrorist organization known as the MEK was also present. So this is definitely bizarre, to say the least. But it is an ongoing thing because, you know, pre-Iraq war, there was a flurry of meetings in Rome and in Paris with members of Iran-Contra from both sides of the ocean, including Michael Ledeen, again with Gurbanifar, and you also have Elliot Abrams sitting as the number two at the you know, National Security Council. So it's really, you know, par for the course.
For those who may not remember, Iran-Contra, in theory, was trying to figure out why or how or, you know, the details of the Reagan administration illegally selling weapons to Iran. It was never, however, there was actually written into the law that authorized the investigation that they could not look back at that period that preceded 1980, I believe it was 82. Mm. In other words, they couldn't look at whether the sale of these weapons to Iran had anything to do with flipping the 1980 election.
And the October surprise.
Right. And as the book by Barbara Honegger so brilliantly documents, and Gary Sick also wrote a book of the same title on the October surprise. I'm curious, Gurbanifar's, am I pronouncing that right?
Yes, you are.
Gurbanifar's participation in the 1980 plan to hold the hostages in order to get Ronald Reagan elected. Any details on that, Larissa?
Not recently. I mean, nothing's changed since those original allegations, but what is interesting is that he continues to function as an extension of Republican foreign policy.
But wasn't he alleged to be one of the people with whom William Casey was meeting about, you know, in the fall of 1980 to organize the holding of the hostages so that Jimmy Carter would lose the election?
Well, it wasn't just Casey. It was also the allegations where Michael Ledeen was also acting as a pigeon, carrier pigeon.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I mean, but the reality is it's even worse than that because, I mean, if you pick any point in the you know, since 1980, you pick any point where there was a scandal and you have the Iran-Contra crew. It is absolutely amazing.
Whether it's BCCI or...
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And even if you go to the manipulation of the intelligence for, you know, the pre-war intelligence for Iraq, you've got these really shady meetings that are closely connected to the Niger forgeries.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, the Niger
sure.
forgeries are the, you know, what came to be known as the 16 words in the president's speech about
right. That came out of Italian intelligence that was apparently
right.
Berlusconi doing a favor for his good friend George,
right,
fellow
right.
fascists.
But again, those there were meetings that closely linked Berlusconi's folks in CISME and other agents who were involved in the Niger forgery documents. And the meetings linked them, or rather linked his folks, to Michael Ledeen, Harold Rode, and Larry Franklin, who, as you know, has now pled guilty to passing classified information to Israel and some suspect Iran. But
right.
there were meetings in Rome and in Paris that, well, you know, that continued even after a lot of Bush officials like Powell and Tenet made noise that this should stop. So the allegations of these, you know, this administration having people meeting overseas with Iranian arms dealers has been going on certainly since at least December 2001, maybe even earlier that year. But what's fascinating is you have the head of the House Intelligence Committee bypassing our...
Pete Hoekstra.
Right, exactly. Bypassing our own intelligence agencies and meeting in a foreign nation with a man who has two burn notices with the CIA. A burn notice is, you know, this guy's a fabricator, a liar, don't...
Right.
meeting overseas with an arms dealer, and now it comes out also, as I mentioned earlier, in the American Conservative, present at the meeting is a terrorist organization representative. So it is really, whatever it is that they're cooking up, I can't imagine it's anything clean.
Now, in the past, they've done a pretty good job of kind of cleaning up the blood off the floor. Barbara Honegger, in her book October Surprise, writes about how President Ronald Reagan signed intelligence authorizations in 84 and 85, which were considered licenses to kill, as we've seen Oliver North and Amiram Nir's USA Israeli covert operations were authorized by a still secret accord. And she goes, author Seymour Hersh has charged Oliver North with being President Reagan's assassin, his assassination planner. He's essentially bragged about that. And then she talks about William Casey, the guy who was also at that meeting.
Right.
William Casey, CIA director, who reportedly attended meetings in Paris, France on October 19 and 20, 1980, with Iranian officials and agents of French intelligence to arrange an arms for hostages delay deal with Iran. Mm-hmm. The morning of his first scheduled under oath testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee on the secret Iran initiative, he was struck by seizures in his CIA headquarters office in Langley, Virginia, and underwent speech incapacitating left brain surgery shortly thereafter. They cut out the part of his brain that is responsible for speech.
Right.
And this is the equivalent of cutting out the tongue, and it's an old mafia thing. Had he lived to testify, according to lifelong friend and counsel Milton Gould, Casey would have told the entire truth. He died on May 6, 1987. I mean, how have some of these guys managed to survive?
I don't know. That is a very good question. I mean, again,
because the Bushes have been very good at killing off the people who participate in these crimes.
Well, right, and you would think that the head of the CIA would probably be the, you know, more the insulated, protected type.
Right.
But these outsiders, you know, that sort of wait for a friendly administration to come into office, whereby they can infiltrate again. Yeah, I don't know how they have survived, but I think it's
could it be possible, Larissa Alexandrovna of rawstory.com, could it be possible that this is actually something that might be good for the United States in that this is, you know, kind of back alley, back door pseudo negotiation that will prevent a war from happening?
No, absolutely not. That's not what Gurbanifar's mission is. His mission is to deliver fabricated information. And now that we know that the MEK representatives were there, you know, let's rewind for a minute. The Mujahideen El-Kak, MEK for short, is a terrorist organization that the United States has been in league with and using using some of their ground soldiers, if you will, in the southern region of Iran to assassinate Iranian officials.
Right, for some time now, and
right.
rather unabashedly at that.
Right, exactly. And since, you know, 2004, and mind you, these guys are on the State Department's terror watch group list. And the way they got around that was the Department of Defense, and primarily Donald Rumsfeld and his, you know, his associates, was to simply have members of this organization resign the organization.
Right.
So they, and that's,
I'm not a terrorist anymore. We have about 30 seconds, Larissa. Do you see this as then a setup for an invasion of Iran? Is that what you're seeing here?
I really don't know. I think I'm hearing that this is, you know, certainly part of fabricating information and, you know, planting it out there. For example, there was a recent allegation that Iran attempted to buy uranium from Congo.
Oh, jeez.
Right. So it's kind of like
we've seen this movie before.
Right. Exactly. It's one of it's an ongoing kind of disinformation campaign. Is what I'm hearing is one of the possible reasons for these meetings. The other possibility is an October surprise in November. I simply don't know.
Right, which, if there are election irregularities, would suddenly cause us to stop talking about those election irregularities.
Right,
if the elections are stolen. Yeah, there's a lot of talk about that now, that they're not going to do an October surprise. They're going to do a November surprise.
Yeah, right.
November 8th, 9th, 10th. Larissa Alexandrova, you can read all about it over at rawstory.com. Larissa, you're doing some of the best reporting in the business. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Now listen, I watched the news last night on TV. Another scandal up there in D.C. Jack Abramoff, Duke Cunningham, and Tom DeLay. Well, there's a new one most every other day. And you got Halliburton camped out in the lobby, making handshake deals.
behind closed doors. You better do something fast about the price of gas, cause I've been paying for mine and for yours. I'm taking my country back.
Yes, indeed, my friends. Time to take our country back, one congressional district at a time. We are highlighting good Democrats running for Congress, who places where, you know, if you're in a safe seat, you can go to their website and toss some money their way, help them out. This is the on the ground, this is the grassroots way to take back an election. Today, Wendy Wild, she's running for Congress in the 3rd District of Minnesota for the House of Representatives. Her website, electmom.com. Hey, Wendy.
Hi there, Tom. Boy, I really related to your bumper song there.
Isn't it great?
Well, I was a country music DJ for about 12 years.
That's where I started in as a country western DJ for, well, it was only about a year, but it was long ago, but it's great music. Anyhow, so your website is probably one of the lighter of the campaign websites that I've seen. You say, you know, play fair, do your homework, clean up after yourself, always do your best, and enough is enough. You're five tenants, and we won't change what's going on in Washington until we change the people we send there. I'm assuming that you're a serious candidate, and you want to be taken as a serious candidate.
Mm-hmm. You know, we knew that it was going to get dirty. It's been getting dirty here in politics for the last, we didn't used to be like that either, but for the last, oh boy, 6 or so years, it's been getting really, really nasty. And we knew everybody would be sick of it. And we thought, you know, we're the little guy. I'm running against a guy who's got more than $1 million in his campaign treasury. Less than 15% of that money this year came from individuals who even live in our district. Less than 15%. So we're the little guy, we're the underdog, and we had to do something a little more creative to get people to pay attention. And we thought, Elect Mom, it speaks values. It's who I am. I, besides being a mom, I founded a teen center to give kids safe activities to keep them out of trouble on the weekends, and I spend about 40 weekends a year there. So the Elect Mom thing comes near and dear to my heart, and we just knew that the voters were going to be sick of all the mudslinging, and they wanted something to lift them up instead of beat them down.
Well, and there's real issues underneath this stuff. Let's just go through these quickly
In
the 5 minutes or so that we have here, Wendy Wild. Mm-hmm. We're talking with Wendy Wild, her website, electmom.com. She's running for the 3rd District in Minnesota. Play fair, number one, play fair.
Well, you know, lighthearted or not, I think that that's just about as serious as it gets. Americans are fed up with the corruption and the big money wheeling dealing in Congress. They're tired of underhanded campaign tactics and play fair. Yeah, everybody in America should have a fair chance and the same opportunities as everyone else.
You talk about the American dream is for everyone. Let's stop giving unfair tax breaks for millionaires and giant industries.
Small businesses are the backbone of America, and the way that this administration, with the Congress complicit in it, the way that this administration has structured business, the little guy can't compete.
Yeah. Do your homework, you say, number two.
Oh, you know, to me, where that comes really close to home is how Congress has been shoving through enormous bills and not giving our elected officials the opportunity to read what they're voting on.
Yeah. Not to mention, and on your website, you mentioned No Child Left Behind, Medicare Part D, gutting FEMA, privatizing Social Security. These are all things that are problematic in your mind, Wendy Wild?
Oh, I'm very concerned. I'm you know, where to begin? I know we don't have a long time to really dig into these issues. No Child Left Behind has taken money out of teaching and forced our schools to put that money to testing or they lose their federal funding. Here in Minnesota, we value our schools and small classroom sizes, so we then turn around and vote to raise our property taxes so we can try to fully fund schools and make up for the shortfall. So that's just one example. No Child Left Behind, it sounded great. It was a gimmick, and we've learned that these gimmicks always fall short with this administration, and this one has. It's got a great title, and it doesn't do what it says.
Well, one of George Bush's brothers is making a lot of money with it.
Well, so I guess it depends on where your priorities lie, whether or not it's a success, right?
Yeah, good old Neil. He started one of these companies that's selling stuff to schools with that have mandated through No Child Left Behind. A minute left we have here. Minnesota children should be able to eat the fish they catch in our lakes, so why are we going backwards on environmental standards? Number three, clean up after yourself.
You know, the guy I'm running against talks like a moderate,
And this is Jim Ramstad.
And Jim Ramstad. And the interesting thing about my race is, and we're not one of the DNC's targeted races, but what's most interesting is this district, Minnesota 3rd District, had the second largest swing from Republican to Democrat in overall votes in 2004, second largest swing in America.
Wow.
I know. We believe that this district is poised and ready to change. And when I'm out there and I'm at the street level talking to not the political insiders but the average Joes, they are saying, I'm fed up. I've had it. I'm going to vote straight Democratic ticket. I'm going to change what's going on. I refuse to let these fat cats go on anymore. And that's what my whole campaign is looking at, is all of these issues that are not getting taken care of. And Ramstad, who talks about being endorsed by the environmental groups, his vote record on environmental issues has been getting lower every year for the last 6 years. Every year it's worse instead of better.
Indeed. Wendy Wild, she's running for Minnesota's 3rd District. No matter where you are in the United States, you can help her out by going to electmom.com. Wendy Wild, thanks for being with us today.
Love your show, Tom. Thank you.
Good luck. Good luck. I wish you the very best. 27 minutes past the hour. Minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, fair and slightly unbalanced. Listener-supported radio brought to you by our sponsors. Yes, we support free enterprise in the United States. Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, all organic, all fair trade, and incredibly good coffee. I mean, you're not going to believe it. This is incredible stuff. SacredGroundsCoffee.com, 1-800-425-2532 is their telephone number. Give them a call and say hi, 1-800-425-2532. And Small Dog Electronics. Get the latest iPods now, all things Macintosh, 1-800-511-MAX. SmallDog.com, their website. Ian Inaba is with us. Ian and I were on a panel together at the Bioneers Conference a week or so ago in San Rafael, California. He is a documentary filmmaker and, just doing all kinds of cool stuff here. Ian, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Two websites, videothevote.org and AmericanBlackout.org. Let's talk about American Blackout first and just get that kind of out of the way so that we can get into the, and also end the blackout.org. American Blackout, this is this movie.
Yeah, this is a documentary film that I was making over the past 3 years, which documents the voter disenfranchisement issue from Florida 2000 through Ohio 2004. And through that filmmaking experience, I really have seen that, you know, there is this change of citizen oversight and activism in regards to our election systems. I think that Florida 2000 was really this big turning point where people realized that we had problems with our elections and they wanted to do something about it. And so I've taken this film all across the country, you know, screened in probably 20 states, and it just outrages people to see this issue kind of being shown to them in full light. And so what we've done is that we've designed a campaign called End the Blackout, where we are asking people to kind of join us in making a stand against voter disenfranchisement, because not everybody encounters problems. Most people in this country don't encounter problems when they go to vote. But there is a growing disparity between the understanding of those people and then the people in the more targeted districts that do experience those problems on election day. And so we want to kind of bring those communities closer together and have that conversation happen among the American people so that we can find solutions to solve these problems.
Well, and in fact, today the Miami Herald is reporting that in Broward County, Florida, voting machines, when you touch the Democratic candidate, they say, thank you for voting for the Democratic candidate. You register it. And when you get to the very last screen where it summarizes your vote and you push the I'm all done, please store this information screen, which probably a lot of people don't read in detail, the Democratic candidate is no longer checked. The Republican candidate is now checked.
Right.
And, I mean, you know, this is nothing new, but this is happening today. It's reported in the Miami Herald in Broward County right now. As we speak.
Yeah, no, I mean, we are seeing these things already pop up in the early voting, and I think it's a good thing that people are going to do early voting because it's testing out these systems and it's giving us a clue as to where these new tactics are taking place. Because so, that's really what I found through documenting an American blackout, was that the tactics to disenfranchise voters changes every time. It changes every election. And so the election protection organizations have to keep constant watch, but they're always one step behind. And so that's actually why we are now kind of implementing a new program, which we're calling Video the Vote, which is to inspire people as citizens to go out and document on videotape what is going on in their local areas, and then to make those images available on election day before those races are called.
And at the website, you could sign up, say, I have a camera, I'd like to register it as a videographer, and then you just, walk into the precinct? Now, are there concerns because of the privacy of the vote and all that kind of thing? Are there areas that people can't video?
Yes, well, we are putting together, we have guidelines available on the site, as well as we are going to be conducting phone-based and, in some cases, location-based training for people. We are working very closely with the election protection organization, so it's not as if we're just asking people to kind of grab their cameras and go out and film whatever they can get. We are actually going to be tied into the 1-800 numbers where people who are having problems are calling in, so we'll be able to dispatch videographers to the places that we know are encountering problems.
Mm-hmm. And because early voting is happening right now all across the United States in many states, are you getting videos back already?
We have just actually started to deploy some people, like you're saying, down in Florida, as well as there are some other cases that we're looking at around the country as well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And from previous elections, you have plenty of video. That you made this movie, American Blackout. It was mind-boggling. We saw a chunk of it, a preview of it there at Bioneers, and just infuriating. In fact, actually, people can see a preview of it over at your website, videothevote.org or AmericanBlackout.org. How, if somebody wants to show this movie or see this movie, American Blackout, how do they do it, Ian?
Well, yeah, they can order a DVD on our website, AmericanBlackout.org, and we've had a lot of people, we've had hundreds, almost 1,000 people now have conducted a kind of a community screening across the United States. So
house party kind of things?
Yeah, house party kind of thing. But also, we're getting a lot of college campuses, a lot of church organizations. So we try to run this campaign leading up to the election, but we also wanted to extend beyond the election because we know that that's probably also when we're going to be discussing what happened in this election.
Right.
So we encourage people to go on our website, and you can either find a screening in your local area or order a DVD and have your own house party or community screening.
Sounds like a fine plan. Ian Inaba, also you work with Guerrilla News Network, GNN.org, right?
That's right. That's an organization that I helped start about in 1999, and we've been kind of plugging away ever since, and particularly targeting young people to provide them kind of more compelling content than they are offered traditionally through documentary programming. So, but we also are really trying to foster this next wave of citizen journalism, because we really feel that this is the only way that we as American citizens are going to be able to be informed, is that if we inform each other. We can't just trust, you know, the mainstream news outlets, particularly in video or television format, to inform us. And so that's why things like Video the Vote, we're trying to inspire, again, citizen journalists to go out there, document ourselves, and utilize this new infrastructure of the Internet and YouTube in order to keep ourselves informed.
Well said and well done. Ian Inaba, videothevote.org, AmericanBlackout.org, GNN.org. But for today, I guess Video the Vote is the one that everybody should go to first.
Yeah, they can go to Video the Vote and they can sign up. They can also watch a clip of American Blackout and find their way back to the American Blackout site through there as well.
Great. Videothevote.org. Ian, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Keep up the great work.
Yep,
it's remarkable what Ian is doing. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Steve, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. What's on your mind?
Hey, that interview is good calling or good timing. Because I was going to say, you mentioned go out and be a poll watcher. I've already tried to do that in my county, but apparently it's too late. I guess they've already got their poll watchers selected. But what I'm going to do, and I recommend all your listeners do, is watch the actual counting. I'm going to go down to the wherever they tabulate all the results for my county down here and watch, just watch.
Yeah.
I bet this fellow you just talked to probably has instructions on how to do that. I couldn't tell if he was talking about videoing the voting or the tabulation.
All of the above. Basically, you know, go in with a camera and get everything you can.
Okay. And so, also at, what's her name, at Black Box also has.
Yeah, Bev Harris, blackboxvoting.org.
Sure, doing that.
Yeah.
And just want to recommend that.
Good. Well, Steve, thanks a lot for the call.
Take care, Tom.
And thanks for listening. Yep, indeed. Dwayne in Puyallup, Washington.
Oh, hello.
Hello, Dwayne.
Hi, Dwayne in Puyallup. I saw you at King's Bookstore Saturday, and I enjoyed it. You're a true gentleman scholar.
Thank you for coming by.
And I made a quick comment, and you asked me to call the show about it. And part of that is I'm increasingly concerned about the consolidation of major media, the infiltration of the FCC by neocons, the efforts to destroy NPR and CPB, and also a court decision has said that news media are not legally bound to report truthfully. Yes. And I'd like to know why nobody has ever talked about requiring a legal truthfulness in our news media that are using the commons, the public airwaves.
Yeah. Well, I'm assuming that the decision you're talking about was Jane Aker and Steve, I forget his name, her husband's name, versus Fox down in Florida.
Yes.
The Fox RGBH suit.com, I think, is the website. You can certainly Google it, Fox RGBH suit and Jane Aker, A-K-R-E. In that lawsuit, they sued for unlawful termination because they said that the Fox station required them, as a condition of their employment, to lie to their viewers about the dangers of this Monsanto chemical, and they refused to do it, and they were fired, and they were granted a couple hundred thousand dollars and in a wrongful termination suit by a jury of their peers, and then Fox appealed it to an appeals court and won and claimed it a great victory that they had the right to say you must lie, and that gets into issues of free speech. I mean, who's going to be the ultimate arbiter of what's the truth? Do you want Michael Powell? He's not the head of the FCC now, but when he was, do you want him to be the guy who says what's true and what's not?
Oh, absolutely not.
So how do you do it? How do you figure it out?
I don't know, but.
I'm not so concerned about truth in the media because I think truth ultimately comes out. I'm concerned about the media being required to offer news, that is to say in exchange for their use of the public airwaves, that they, in order to keep their license, in exchange for the public airwaves, they have to be offering real news, actual, you know, information more than infotainment, which is how it was prior to Reagan changing the rules in 87 and then Clinton privatizing the airwaves in 96. It gets into that. Dwayne, stick around for just a minute here. I want to get into this just a little deeper. We'll do it on the other side of this break. It's 45 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Program, where being progressive never felt so good.
They took my name. They purged it from the roll. What they gained cannot compare with what they stole. This is my democracy. Don't you go telling me my vote don't matter anymore. And is not worth fighting for. The fix was in. That's all she wrote. They did not win. Our hearts, our minds, our votes.
No, my friends, we're gonna clean this thing up. It may not happen today, it may not happen this week, but it may not happen this year, but it is going to happen because people are waking up to what's going on, and we are taking this country back. It's happening a little more slowly than a lot of us would have liked, but we are taking this country back. Dwayne, just to wrap up this conversation, first of all, did I answer your question or did satisfactorily get into what you wanted to talk about before?
Well, somewhat, but I wanted to make the point that one-time journalists were bound by ethical restraints wherein they were required to authenticate any quotes they might make or attribute them so that they could be researched for truthfulness.
They still are if they're members of the American Society of Journalists.
Well, we've seen many violations of that, including at the New York Times and Fox News and a whole variety of places where they don't seem to be concerned at all.
Sure.
About the truth.
No, I absolutely understand, and journalism has, and there's a lot of people out there who have no background in journalism and did not study journalism in college, who represent themselves as journalists as well, and you know that further muddies the water. You know, it seems like anybody can hang that name on themselves, and probably something like the standards necessary to call yourself a physician should be in place for journalism.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, a different point that I'd like is that I hear you have many interesting interviews, and I'd like really much to hear Dennis Kucinich interviewed more frequently.
Okay, great. That's easily done. Dennis has been on this program four or five times in the last couple of years, and we'll get him back. Dwayne, I got to run. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for showing up at the book signing there at King's Books. It was a great time. Jeff in Denver, Colorado, you have specific instructions on how to get ready to video the vote?
Yeah, we've had a number of instances recently where we've tried to get information from the Denver Election Commission and other entities where they have given misinformation to those who are gathering it. And so everybody should know the Freedom of Information Act laws, their local state open documents laws, and so forth beforehand, because oftentimes when you go talk to county clerks, they may not even be familiar with things.
Sure, and their automatic instinct is to say, no, you can't step behind that curtain.
Yeah, in one case, we were told that we had to have a document saying that we wouldn't use the copies we created in any lawsuit. We needed to use the copies created by the Denver Election Commission. And the person I was talking to who did this, I told her, no, you don't have to, you don't do that. And she says, hey, I'm not going to write this. They go, okay. And then they let her have everything.
Hmm.
But they gave her misinformation to begin with. And this is frequently a problem we've had.
Who's the they?
This is Denver Election Commission, but we've also had problems with Secretary of State's office, you know, and stalling for things. And it happens all over the place. We've had tried to videotape the voting machine testing and have been kicked out. And rules have been broken on that. And so knowing the rules before you get there, and also, if you know any group, if you have an attorney you can talk to, you know, and take your cell phone so you can talk to right there, you can get in lots of times where they will not initially let you in.
Right.
And one key point is record everything. Have your videotape recorder going in before you go into the building, because you want to record yourself, record the discussion with whoever's trying to keep you out or whoever's letting you in.
Right. Assume permission. Better to ask for forgiveness than ask for permission.
Yeah, and but be very bold. Don't just take their word for things. But
please show me that piece of law that says that what you're saying is true, because otherwise I'm going to operate on the assumption that it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great.
And sometimes they can make the rules on the fly. Sometimes the rules are very vague. But actually, besides just knowing the Open Records Acts, knowing the actual election statutes for testing, counting of the vote and so forth, it's very important.
Yeah.
And besides counting of vote, people really need to go and see the machines being tested beforehand, because that's where a lot of the circus is.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, you know, testing, some vote testing, they only run like 25 ballots for each race through a machine. Well, if you have a 1%, if you have a half a percent error rate, that's not going to show up unless you run a few hundred ballots.
Right. Or if you know that they're going to test 25 ballots, you just rig the machine so that the fix doesn't come in until the 26th ballot is counted.
Yeah, and if you do the testing properly, you're supposed to all be like paper ballots. You need to have defective ballots.
Yeah.
Well, in some of the tests recently, they wouldn't allow any defective ballot whatsoever. They said, we don't want to try to trick the machine.
Oh, geez. Okay. Jeff, thanks for the heads up, and let's, videothevote.org. Let's everybody get out there and keep track of what's going on.
And
Jeff,
be prepared, know the rules.
There you go. Be prepared, know the rules. Well said. Joe in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Yes, I've been listening to the last caller, and I just say, wow. But anyway, my comment is about the lady that called and said about the incident down in Florida.
Yeah.
Why can't that be challenged immediately?
I guarantee you it is. It is. Now that the Miami Herald has reported it, it's out there in the blogosphere. It was on the Daily Kos. There's going to be election activists descending upon Broward County from all over planet Earth.
Why not even John Kerry and Al Gore?
Yeah, well, it's a little late for those guys. Al Gore, to his credit, fought all the way to the Supreme Court.
One other comment.
But John Kerry,
And we have a lottery. It's 15 states. To my knowledge, I get a paper thing. I can take it in any time, get a check that this number hit. They can tell when a number hits where the store that was sold in. I mean, and we can't make a voting machine?
Right. Well, yeah, and the same thing with the slot machines in Las Vegas. You know, they're certified, they're randomly tested, they're subject to all kinds of inspections and oversight. None of those things are true of the voting machines. I mean, it's a miserable mess. And Joe, a good point. Thank you very much for making it. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Got to wrap up the show. We'll be back tomorrow. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, Wayne Madsen is here on Jaded Task, Brass Plates, Black Ops, and Big Oil. The Blood Politics of George Bush and Company. I'll be debating conservative Ian Murray about global warming and hurricanes. That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, where you're in the Democracy Zone. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.